Welcome to Parenting Matters on Nashville Catholic Radio, WBOU 100.5 FM, sponsored by the Family Life Office of the Diocese of Nashville. Your host for the program is Dr. Parr Donahue. Dr. Parr has years of experience in pediatrics and parenting. He was named the Senior Pediatrician of the Year by the Tennessee Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2014. Dr. Parr is the author of four books, including books on parenting entitled Messengers in Denim, The Amazing Things Parents Can Learn from Teens, and Tools for Effective Parenting. Visit Dr. Parr's blog at www.parentingwithdrparr.com. Here's your host, Dr. Parr Donahue.
Welcome to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org.
Our subject today, what should we do with grandma? Our guest expert is Dr. Wes Ely. I'll tell you more about him in a moment, but first my monologue. Growing old isn't for sissies. Old people face illnesses like heart failure, coronary artery disease, arthritis, as well as cancer and other terminal illnesses. To make life even more worrisome, they often have financial problems or are concerned they will outlive their money or that their brain will wear out before the rest of them does. Add to that, the fact that so many elderly have lost a spouse, have kids living in other states, and have beloved grandchildren scattered throughout the world. All this leads to loneliness and often depression. My grandmother is a case in point. She was in her mid-60s when she suffered a stroke and developed severe dementia. She had been an avid gardener and had a beautiful stand of irises of which she was so proud. One day, she dug up all the irises and threw them into the ditch. My brother and I, not yet teens, were dumbfounded. She explained to us that they were old and done blooming, but we could not convince her that next year they would bloom again. The next morning, when she saw our precious irises in the ditch, she became hysterical and, of course, blamed us poor, but this time innocent, boys. We dutifully replanted the irises, and they bloomed the following year, but not nearly as beautifully displayed as Grandma had had them. Thank God our family was able to care for her, but there must be a better way to deal with elderly parents and grandparents. To discover what has changed in the decades since Grandma died, I have turned to Vanderbilt University Medical Center physician and professor, Dr. Wes Ely, an internist, pulmonologist, and critical care physician with over 25 years of experience in intensive care medicine. He is a noted writer and speaker and a devout Catholic filled with a theological and philosophical knowledge and virtue. He is an active member and past president of Nashville Physicians, Catholic Physicians Guild. Born in Venezuela and raised in Shreveport, Louisiana, he earned his bachelor's degree and his medical degree at Tulane University. His accomplishments would fill several books, but he will be the first to say that his most amazing accomplishments are his three daughters, Taylor and twins Blair and Brooke. His wife, Kim Ely, is an anatomic and clinical pathologist who specializes in head and neck cancer at Vanderbilt. He and his family worship at the Cathedral of the Incarnation Catholic Church in Nashville. Welcome, Dr. Ely, to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world on WBOU.org.
Thank you, Dr. Donahue. It's my privilege to be here, and thank you so much.
Well, before we get started, please tell me what brought you from Venezuela to the States.
I was born in Venezuela. My parents were living there, and my father was working for Pennzoil while my mother taught English. But then my father left us. He got married and told my mother sayonara. So she brought myself, my brother, back to the United States and found out a few weeks later she was pregnant with my sister. And so she proceeded to raise us as a single mother in the United States, up in the Catholic Church and in a little four-room house on a teacher's salary as growing up in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Wow. She had it rough. Congratulations. Tell her congratulations when you see her. Shake her hand for me, would you please?
Thank you. She's amazing.
Before we get started further, I want to ask one more thing, because nothing tells me more about a father than to hear him say he's proud of his children. How old are your daughters?
My daughters are in the mid-20s, and I'm extremely proud of them. They all have a heart of gold. I have one daughter who works in an orphanage and is becoming a social worker. Another who is studying psychology because she wants to do healthcare reform for nursing homes, and she is passionate about end-of-life care. And the third one, of whom is an environmental engineer and she's studying hydrology so she can help us with the world's water shortage.
Cool. Great. Certainly elder care has changed a lot in the past 7 decades. But tell us, what does 2021 have to offer old people that was not available in rural Minnesota in the early 50s?
I think it has a tremendous amount to offer old people. Elder care has moved in a beautiful direction, especially in keeping with our faith, in that we always want to magnify the human dignity of each person. And what we know now is that during times of illness, especially as we get an advanced stage and acquire diseases, that suffering can be profound. And what's new now is just a really magnification of palliative care. And I mean that only in the most beautiful sense, where we try and allow somebody to lead the normal extent of their life from conception to death with the reduction of human suffering to allow their life to take its natural course. So in the hospital, whether it be in the ICU or the wards or in the outpatient setting, we are just getting so much more conscious of the need for palliation of suffering. And by that, I do not mean in any way physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia.
You use the word palliative, and that reminds me of hospice care. What is the difference between palliative care and hospice care?
Well, palliation just means, of course, to enter into the suffering and reduce suffering. And hospice care would be more specific at the very end of life. So in the United States, the hospice definition is we have to invoke hospice care, we have to invoke that somebody has less than 6 months to live. That's a very bad definition. It's a poor definition. And all of us in healthcare think it's kind of ridiculous because we don't have a crystal ball to know who's going to live 5.9 months versus 6.1 months. So that's artificial. But palliative care applies in all circumstances where there's human suffering. And we're getting more and more excited about the ability to provide appropriate palliative care services to people who are not anywhere near within 6 months of their life. And what that looks like is just the principles of making sure that we understand what's proportionate and disproportionate to any individual, or another way of saying that, ordinary versus extraordinary, and providing for them relief of that suffering so that they can lead better lives with those that they love.
Well, I read a paper saying that early palliative care is helpful to the patient because for many reasons, and we'll discuss them in a minute, but it also showed that physicians and nurses who were involved with early palliative care had less stress and more feelings of reward in their treatment of the patient. Can you explain that?
Yes, that's a great point, Dr. Donahue. You know, for those people like me who deal with death so often at the bedside, I think that introducing palliative care earlier is actually like a burnout prevention program. What I learn through earlier palliative care is that I do a better job in providing the most whole patient care. I see the person in the patient better by asking the patient, instead of telling the patient, here's what's the matter with you, I ask the patient, what matters to you? I switch the preposition. What matters to you? And then just by entering into that dialogue and looking the person in the eyes, holding their hand, kneeling at the bedside, I get to listen to them, tell me what matters to them, and then direct their care towards that. So if they tell me, for example, you know what, doc, I've got this cancer, and all I really want to do is make it to my son's wedding or to my grandchild's graduation, then I can steer all of my directions towards that, all my directives and my medical decisions to getting them to those goals. And palliative care is a beautiful way of doing that in many circumstances.
Well, it seems some of us have a very hard time talking to people about death. Now, I worked in pediatrics, and of course, it's a little bit different talking about the death of your child than it is the death of your grandmother. But that's important. How do you train physicians to do that, to get inside there and talk with the patients about something so sensitive?
Well, what we have to do is help our younger physicians and younger nurses realize, and sometimes they're the ones teaching me, so I don't want to be, you know, pedantic or patronizing about this, but death is part of life. And we have a beautiful way of seeing that Christ commented that there's a baptism with which I must be baptized. And he's, of course, not talking about the River Jordan. He's talking about his own death. And we have to know that all of our patients, and of course, this is not invoking Christianity for all of them, but all of our patients, whether they be atheist, agnostic, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or Christian, or any of these in between, they're going to experience death. So we have got to get really good at paying attention to what matters to people, whether they're going to survive immediately or not, and whether death is imminent or on the more distant horizon, it's part of that person's life path. So each physician needs to know that this is not a scary subject. It's not something that we can sweep under the rug. It's got to be, if they're going to really take care of the entire person and see the person in the patient, then death needs to be part of our conversation with each of our patients.
That makes so much sense. Thank you. There is a lot of facility available for older people who need care, and from assisted living to nursing homes and then hospice care. Can you tell me a little bit about what's the difference between independent living, assisted living, nursing homes with or without nursing care? What's the difference?
Sure, sure. You know, I mean, just as I said, it's part of the person's life path. Each person has to be, we have to see each person's individual circumstances. And, you know, the Pope in Evangelium Vitae talks beautifully about being honest about one person's place in their own life. And so if a person is still able to walk and get around and drive, et cetera, then an independent living facility would obviously be better. But as their life progresses on its natural course, they may not be able to do that and need something more of a skilled nature, like a SNF or a skilled nursing facility. When they progress even further, they might even be in the medical facility of such an organization. A nursing home is less independent. It's more community living. It's something where somebody has to be more dependent on their community and can't live such an individualized lifestyle. And then hospice, of course, is when we recognize that somebody is more actively dying, more in the neighborhood, and I put things in the neighborhood of hours and days, days and weeks and months. And as soon as we know that somebody's in the weeks to months category, it's appropriate to consider for them hospice care. I'm going to stop there and see what your next question is, but I would like to explain to you how I flip it. Let's put that in quotes, flip it. When people ask me, how long does mama have to live or how long does daddy have to live? And I can explain to you how I address that if you'd like.
Go ahead. I'd be very interested right now.
Okay, fantastic. That's what the greatest part of illness and of aging is the uncertainty of not knowing. It's when somebody, you know, there are aspects of our life and our path that we don't understand. And that black box just tends to drive us crazy as humans because we want to be in control. I'm actually in the middle right now of the surrender novena with my wife. Dear Jesus, I completely surrender myself to you. Take care of everything. And so that's my goal to get there. But many of us have a hard time getting there, right? So yes. When somebody says, you know, doc, how long do I have to live or how long does mama have to live? I tell them this. That's an honest question. And I'm going to flip it over for you because I don't have a crystal ball to tell you how long they have to live, but I can tell you how quickly they can die. So rather than predict something I don't know, I will tell you that I would be surprised if they live more than a week or two, or than a week or a month, or than several hours or several days. So I put in those categories, and that way, instead of telling them how long they'll live, I prepare them for the earliest possibility of death. Obviously, we can all die today, but I give them my medical opinion of what's more likely. And it helps prepare people so that they can do their best with what they usually avoid doing, which is a worst-case scenario.
Well, I think that really helps. You know, my folks spent their last few years in a nursing home, and they missed the little home they spent 50 years in. But they came to love the wonderful nuns who ran and worked there. They were not happy that they weren't home, but they were happy that they had such good care. And she says the two things that brought their attention and mine too when I visited them was the sisters who ran that place were absolutely the most wonderful people I have ever met. They were just happy all the time. And you think, how can you be happy when you're dealing with everybody who's old and, you know, many of them are moribund? And it was just, but they were the happiest people I've ever met. And the other thing that they liked was that they could now go to daily mass because they had mass at the place every day. And they were very pleased with that. So, Wes, how important is religion to elderly people? I mean, how do you approach that?
You talk about these happy sisters. You know, what a joy it is to join in to the life of another human being. And in so doing, to see God there. That's all we have in life is our search for God, ultimately. And to see God through in the windows to the soul of another human being. And so when those sisters were taking care of your parents, that's what they were doing. They were looking at Jesus Christ in them, at God in them, whatever your higher power, whatever you call your higher power. And that's where joy emanates from. My own great-grandfather was a Protestant, and he had a newspaper down in Mississippi. And when he started standing up for the blacks in Mississippi, the KKK burned down his newspaper, and it sent him on an existential search for truth. Eventually, his choice was to convert to Catholicism. And so our whole family did so. And that's why I'm Catholic today. And I'm very thankful to him for that. In the process of doing that, however, what he found was what he said was ultimate joy. And so religion, as he went further in his life, became increasingly important to him. Now, not everybody has religion as important to them. They might just have a not so structurally important higher power approach, more like an AA or an Al-Anon approach of terminology. But I do think that everybody's path is enhanced and made more beautiful when they allow themselves to pursue a search for their creator.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. You know, when you speak of joy, it's hard to define, but these nuns defined joy. And one of the nuns that I became quite fond of, she was in Minnesota, and I'm in Tennessee, so it's hard to get to know them well. But every time I go up there, she would be there. And my mother had a copy of my book, Messengers in Denim, which is a parenting book, and she carried it with her. So one of the nuns says, well, your mom is so proud of your book, and she carries it every place. She reads it to people, and she's always talking about it. And I said, well, have you read it? And she said, well, no. I said, I'll get you a copy, and I'll even sign it for you. And he said, well, thanks, but you see, I'm blind.
Yeah.
I go, you're blind? Here she's been talking to me. She's been, you know, walking these halls, and she, of course, always touches the door as she goes along. But just a habit, I never thought of it. She's blind. And here's a blind woman who can't read anymore, who's the most joyful person in the world. And I think that joy, like, because it comes from being involved in helping other people. I want to change the subject just a little bit now, Wes, and talk about medical care directives. When I go to the hospital, to the nursing, to the doctors or to the surgery centers, and the first thing they ask me for is, do I have my power of attorney, and do I have my living will and my medical directives? And I always feel like, well, am I going to go to a court, or am I going to go to the doctor's office? What are these documents, and why are they needed?
Well, I think the most important aspect of these documents to understand is, what's the best way for me or for your wife or for your mother or whoever it is in your life to communicate their wishes to those who are going to be caring for them? And to be quite honest, if I was able to ask you or your wife for you, if she was your surrogate, what your wishes were, and if she had talked about this with you and knew your preferences, I don't need those documents at all. Nothing. All I need to know to take care of you is, what are your preferences? Mm-hmm. So, for example, when it comes down to treatment of you, whether it be people think of extensive life support, like a ventilator or ECMO or CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, but it really goes down even to antibiotics, transfusions, or any even diagnostic tests. The decision of whether or not to do these things really rests upon your determination as a person of whether they are proportional to your life circumstances or disproportional. proportionate or disproportionate? In other words, would you think that being on a ventilator was part of ordinary care for you, or would you think it was extraordinary and something that you would not feel comfortable with? And that will vary by the person. And the person who decides whether something is proportionate, disproportionate, ordinary, extraordinary is not me, the doctor. No, it's the patient. And healthcare professionals get confused about that all the time. And they think, well, I would, if I was this person, I'd go on a ventilator. Well, great. I'm glad to know what you would do if you were the person, but you're not the person. The person is the person in that bed right there. And so these documents you ask about are just an effort to try and help communicate what that person thinks is proportionate, disproportionate, ordinary, or extraordinary. I want to make sure I get on the table here one specific type called a MOLST or PULSED, which is medical order for life-sustaining therapy or physician order for life-sustaining therapy. This goes a step beyond a advanced directive in that it's a special type of an advanced directive where the doctor does it with the patient and they agree on these lists and then they both sign it. The doctor signs it, the patient signs it. That's kind of the most obvious way to make certain that if I'm your doctor and we get you a PULSED sign, physician order for life-sustaining therapy, and then you get sick in Iowa and go to a hospital and you've got your MOLST or PULSED, not only do they know that what your preferences are, but they know that your doctor agreed with you as well, and they're very unlikely to overturn that. So we're just trying to improve communication is the bottom line.
Well, thank you. That clears that up very much. Dr. Ely, there's an article you were part of a study I read in the Journal of Palliative Care a couple of years ago. It's just five reasons why physicians should not be involved in assisted suicide. And it concludes with, physicians have a duty to eliminate pain and suffering, not the person with the pain and suffering. So solutions for suffering lie in improving palliative care and social conditioning and addressing the reasons for physician-assisted suicide. How did you come to that conclusion and why?
Well, I believe that I did not endow my own life. My life was a gift to me, and every day the sun comes up, I treat it as a gift and I cherish it. While I do have free will, and I do have the right to return that gift if I so choose, which in this case that would be, you know, if I chose to end my life, that would be suicide. I certainly do not have the right to impose that on anyone else. And even if they tell me to do it, I think that the value of their life, which is absolutely priceless, outweighs their own decision or request. In other words, I think that I have no right or jurisdiction, if you want to look at it in the legal term, to end the life of another human being because they are priceless and they are a somebody. And I don't have the right to make a somebody into a nobody. That's the basics of this. I want to compare and contrast what I was getting at earlier with treatment choices. We withdraw and withhold treatments all the time, such as a ventilator or life support, whenever we think of something as, or whenever we're told by a patient is proportionate, that's disproportionate or extraordinary. We will not use a ventilator if somebody says, no, I do not, that's way too much for me. And I don't feel that it's ethically appropriate for me to be placed on that life support. We withhold or withdraw that. That is completely different than a choice to actively end the life of a person. Mm-hmm. What we're doing when we withdraw something or withhold it is we're allowing the life to take its natural course. Mm-hmm. And we are not crossing the bright line of actively engaging an action which will take the life or shorten the life of a person. And so that bright line is what I believe is unethical to cross. Another way of saying it would be, we want to cure whenever we can, which sometimes we want to relieve suffering whenever we can, which we said earlier, and we want to comfort always, but harm never. And even if somebody says I'm suffering, I want to end my life. I invoke that I would be harming them if I was to take their life. So I would invoke palliative care and reduction of suffering rather than an active ending of their life.
You know, I love that quote. It's actually from William Osler, I think, said that first.
That was beautiful.
Isn't it? It is just great. I think he said, diagnose, often can treat sometimes, but we can comfort always. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's just such a great motto for physicians. Well, Dr. Udalai, it's been wonderful having you on it. We just thank you very, very much. But we are running out of time.
If I can make a closing comment.
Yes.
The closing comment I would make is about the area of feeding. This gets very confusing to people. And I just want to make the distinction, especially in Catholic circles, people get very confused about the difference between means and mechanism. So means is the food itself. And food is always considered ordinary care and part of natural life. But the mechanism, that is the means by which you, the way you give the food, whether it's a Dolbhoff tube or a PEG tube, a surgically placed tube, et cetera, that's quite different. So one of the things that I offer people at end of life when they can't take food, maybe their bowels are obstructed, maybe their intestinal lining is swollen, maybe they're bloated, maybe it's uncomfortable to them. What I offer families is, you know, take honey on a spoon and offer them honey on a spoon, and it's beautiful, it's loving, it connects the two people who are in love with one another. It's digested by the mouth itself. It's not aspirated because it's thick. It's sweet. So it provides a moment of sweetness and love, and it's a loving action. And so when somebody really feels they need to deliver some calories and food itself, the mechanism of delivering the food is obstructed and not proportionate any longer, then we can say no more food, but yes to honey on a spoon. Does that make sense?
Oh, but that's beautiful. Thank you so much, Doctor, for sharing this time with us. And a big thank you, too, to our listeners. Without you, we wouldn't exist. You are listening to Parenting Matters on WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming throughout the world at WBOU.org. Before we sign off, one quick story. My parents had the great privilege of living to be in their upper 90s, but the last year in their home was uncomfortable for them. They had 12 calls to 9/11. My dad had fallen often because of a heart problem, and mother was in a wheelchair due to back and hip problems. One day she fell in the bathroom and my sister and dad could not get her up. After a successful lift by the EMTs, the family decided with resistance from mom and dad to have them go to a nursing home. Dad went because he knew mom needed more help, and mom went because dad was always fainting. After several months, one of the nuns reported that one evening my mother was making quite a scene about not being in her own home. Dad became upset too and explained to her, "We'll never get out of here if you keep acting like that." But she calmed down right away. Now, for your homework, get together with your parents, grandparents, and or siblings and go to www.parenting-matters.com and listen to the show again. Discuss with them what they have planned for their later years. Then ask yourselves and them if they have medical care directive and assign someone power of attorney. Find out, too, if they have long-term health care. Then return to parenting-matters.com and tell us how it went. And if there's a topic you would like to hear discussed on Parenting Matters, let us know. We'll find an expert to tell us all about it. Thanks for listening, and may God continue to bless you and your family.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Parenting Matters with Dr. Parr Donahue. Parenting Matters is produced and recorded inside the studios at the Catholic Pastoral Center. Thanks again for listening to WBOU 100.5 FM and streaming at WBOU.org.